Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo. And we're here tonight to bring
you some news. Yeah. And we have a couple of interviews. I'm not sure which one Leo is playing for you tonight, but it'll be from our Q103 show.
Yeah,
that was an FM show
last night
in Lakeville, Connecticut.
Yeah.
Out of Lakeville, Connecticut. Which interview are you going to do?
I'm going to do Steve Nato's interview tonight. I'm just trying to get it up here. But this is, I'm hoping that this will work. This is a interview with Steve Nato, who is the large carnivore manager for the Idaho Fish and Game Department, and he's the leading authority, or is an authority on the delisting on the wolf population and issue in western United States. His area is not only Idaho, but it serves Wyoming and Montana and parts of surrounding states. But he's an expert in that area, of course, and been at it for 30 years. So he's, and he'll be talking about the delisting of the wolves population, as well as the what it means and what good things about what's going on there. And interesting, it was an interesting
interview.
So we'll be getting involved with that.
But in the meantime, we have some news for you, and this is from Global Research, and this is Jewish Town in Galilee Demands Loyalty Oath. And we just we have to be concerned about this, because I'm reading this because it shows how undemocratic the state of Israel really is.
But we want to be careful tonight as well, because, I mean, we do read a lot of things regarding Palestine on this show, but with the recent museum shooting and a lot of anti-Semitism out there, we don't want to promote it. But what we want to do is to
point out the inequities
that are out there and try to do it fairly, which the media has never done regarding the Israeli-Palestinian issue, and that's where we're at.
And Israel itself is presented in the American press as a democracy. But what American people need to understand is not a democracy, it's a theocracy.
It is. And it's not only that, it's
and the theocracy
is
a religious state.
Yeah, and only to Jews. Not to anybody else living in that state, which
so if you were a Christian,
yeah,
you wouldn't be treated very well over there either.
And if you're a Palestinian, forget about it, or an Arab.
And
this is what's happening here with this particular article, which we think is quite offensive.
And it's about Zionism, not about the religion,
right.
Judaism.
We want to make
that's
people understand
very
that.
Separate.
Yeah.
And it's the Zionists, which are a geopolitical movement that we have to be very concerned about.
Right, who has hijacked their religion, basically.
That's exactly right. They treated their own people worse than they've ever treated anybody else.
And there are a number of organizations like Jews for Peace and others that are trying to fight this and are supporting the Palestinian
conservative Jews are against Zionism. And very often they lobby against it, they protest against it, but it's never covered in the media.
Right.
And this is Jewish Town in Galilee Demands Loyalty Oath. Ms. Gav, a community in northern Israel, has changed its bylaws to demand that new residents pledge support for Zionism, Jewish heritage, and settlement of the land in a thinly veiled attempt to block Arab applicants from gaining admission. Critics are calling the bylaws adopted by Manoff, home to 170 Jewish families in Galilee, a local loyalty oath, similar to a national scheme recently proposed by the far right-wing party of the government minister, Avigdor Lieberman. Other Jewish communities in the central Galilee following under the umbrella of a regional council known to Ms. Gave, are preparing similar bylaws in response to a court petition filed by an Arab couple hoping to build a home in Ms. Gave. Traditionally, some 700 rural communities in Israel, including 30 in Ms. Gave, have weeded out Arab applicants by issuing automatic rejections through a special vetting committee. Arab citizens make up one-fifth of the country's population. A bill proposed by Mr. Lieberman's Yisrael Beitenu party that conditions citizenship on declaring loyalty to a Jewish state was rejected by a ministerial committee last week. Mr. Lieberman campaigned in February's general election on a platform of no loyalty, no citizenship. Such views are widely held, according to polls. One in 2006 found that 68% of Israeli Jews would refuse to live next door to an Arab, and 46% would not allow an Arab to visit their home. This sounds very much like it used to be in this country with black Americans, and it certainly is not that way today. The bylaws, accepted by an overwhelming majority in Menof, stipulates that applicants must share the values of the Zionist movement, Jewish heritage, settlement of the land of Israel, and observance of Jewish holidays. So that shows you that it's a theocracy. It also proposes that local children be encouraged to join the Zionist youth movement and the Israeli army. Ms. Gav promotes itself in the words of its website as a model of ethnic pluralism because it includes 5,000 Bedouins. However, critics note that Ms. Gav's Bedouins live in a handful of separate communities deprived of the land available to the Jewish communities. The Bedouin inhabitants are generally denied basic services such as water and electricity, as well as schools and medical clinics. In one, Arab al-Naim, the inhabitants are forced to live in tin shacks because permanent structures are demolished by the state. Last week, three members of the Israeli parliament introduced a bill stipulating that vetting committees should assess candidates' suitability to the community's way of life and social fabric. The legislature said that that bill would help in maintaining the Zionist vision. So Americans need to understand what it is that they're supporting, not what they think they're supporting or what the media leads them to believe. And I think most Americans would not support a theocracy like that, so that people are discriminated against because of their religious beliefs in that state. I mean, we had a history of discriminating against people because of their color. And Martin Luther King changed all that.
I read this, but I only got part of it read last night. Now I was wondering if you might want to read that again, because I only read the first couple paragraphs.
Oh, this is from the SundayHerald.com. Key figures in the global battle against the legal arm trade lost in the Air France crash. Amid the media frenzy and speculation over the disappearance of Air France's ill-fated Flight 447, the loss of two of the world's most prominent figures in the war on the illegal arms trade and international drug trafficking has been virtually overlooked. Pablo Dreyfus, a 39-year-old Argentine who is traveling with his wife, Anna Karina Carolina Rodriguez, aboard the doomed flight from Rio de Janeiro to Paris, had worked tirelessly with Brazilian authorities to stem the flow of arms and ammunition that, for years, had fueled the bloody turf wars waged by drug gangs in Rio's sprawling favela. Also traveling with Dreyfus on the doomed flight was his friend and colleague, Ronald Dreyer, a Swiss diplomat and coordinator of the Geneva Declaration on Arms Violence, who had worked with the UN mission in El Salvador, Mozambique, Azerbaijan, Kosovo, and Angola. Both men were consultants at the Small Arms Survey, an independent think tank based at Geneva's Graduate Institute of International Study. The survey said on its website that Dreyer had helped mobilize the support of more than 100 countries to the cause of disarmament and development. Buenos Aires-born Dreyfus has been living in Rio since 2002, where he and his sociologist wife worked with Brazilian Nego Viva Rio. Pablo will be remembered as a gentle and sensitive man with an upbeat sense of humor, said the Small Arms Survey. He displayed an intellectual curiosity and a determined work ethic that excited and enthused all who worked with him. According to the International Actions Network on Small Arms Control, Dreyfus' work was instrumental in the introduction of a landmark small arms legislation in Brazil in 2003. Under this legislation, an online link was created between army and police databases listing production, imports, and exports of arms and ammunition in Brazil. Dreyfus was an advocate of the stringent labeling of ammunition by weapons firms, arguing that by clearly identifying ammunition, not only by its producer, but also its purchaser, the likelihood of weapons being sourced by criminals from corrupt police, or armed forces personnel is greatly reduced. Through a Brazilian referendum on the right to bear arms was rejected in 2005, Viva Rio says the campaign should be considered a success because 500,000 weapons were voluntarily handed over to authorities. Anti-gun activists put the referendum defeat down to the fears of criminals would circumvent the law and continue to gain access to small arms the usual way through Paraguay and other bordering countries. This was not an irrational fear until 2004, when Paraguay bowed to Brazilian pressure. Even foreign tourists were allowed to purchase small arms simply by presenting a photocopy of their ID card. Dreyfus knew that many of the weapons from the so-called tri-border area between Brazil, Paraguay, and the Argentine were reaching Rio drug gangs. When unidentified gunmen made off with a stash of hand grenades from an Argentine military garrison in 2006, Dreyfus deplored what he said was lack of security at military depots across the world. If a supermarket can keep control of the amount of peas it has in stock, surely a military organization could and should be able to do the same with equal, if not greater, efficiency with its weapons, he said. The key words are logistics, control, and security. When Rio agents smashed a cell of drug traffickers who had sourced their weapons from the tri-border area, Dreyfus noted its leaders were prominent businessmen living in the apartments in the plush Rio suburbs of Ipanema and Sao Corrado, not in the favelas. In a recent report posted on the Brazilian website Comunidade Segura, Safe Community, Dreyfus noted that the Brazilian arms from CBC, Companhia Brasileira de Cachorros, I guess, that's in the Spanish, has become one of the world's biggest ammunition producers by purchasing Germany's metalwork and of the Czech Republic in March. This would be particularly noteworthy, but for the fact that CBC exports had tapered off in recent years. Do you want me to read
the article? No, you're just saying it. No, you're okay.
Okay. However, manufacturers from the countries had moved in to fill the void, and before its purchase of CBC and SNB was already one of the marks most currently apprehended by Brazilian police. This doesn't make sense to me. Wait a minute. Let me reread this, folks. However, manufacturers from other countries had moved in to fill the void, and before its purchase by CBC, S&B, that's Cellier and Beloit, was already one of the marks most currently apprehended by Brazilian police. Dreyfus said that in view of the fact that the Czech Republic was bound by the EU Code of Conduct on Weapons Exports, which states that EU countries must evaluate the existence of the risk that an armament can be diverted to an undesirable final destination, CBC should consider the risk that some of these exports end up via diversions feeding violence in Brazil. Oh, they could have said that much more simply. It was kind of long. Though his focus was on Latin America, Dreyfus also advised the government of Mozambique and at the time of his death was preparing to do the same for the government of Angola, where stockpiles of weapons left over from the Civil War continued to pose a security problem. Dreyfus and Dreyer were on their way to Geneva to present the latest edition of the Small Arms Survey Handbook, of which Dreyfus was the joint editor. It was to have been their latest step in their relentless fight against evil. So that's really sad that the world has lost two people who are trying very hard to make the world a better place by opposing the illegal arm trades in South America and in Africa and around the world. And they were also opposed to international drug trafficking. They tried very hard, and they were killed in that flight 447 over the Atlantic Ocean last week. That's very sad. Do you have something that you wanted to read, Leo?
NSA study shows sun responsible for planet warming. And if you just hold on here, your phones are okay. Let's see. From the Daily Tech, NASA study shows sun responsible for planet warming. From Daily Tech, we have still more evidence that any warming occurring on planet Earth is coming from natural sources and is cyclic in nature, not from the evil capitalism that Al Gore and UN politicians at the IPCC and other socialists love to blame. From the article, now a new... Excuse me one second, I'm just... from the article, it says that now a new research report from a surprising source may help to lay the skepticism to the rest. A study from NASA, Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, looking at climate data over the past century, has concluded that solar variation has made a significant impact on the Earth's climate. The report concludes that evidence for climate changes based on solar radiation can be traced back as far as the Industrial Revolution. Past research has shown that the sun goes through 11-year cycles. At the cycle's peak, solar activity occurring near sunspots is particularly intense, basking the Earth in solar heat. According to Robert Callahan, a climatologist at the Goddard Space Flight Center, right now, he says, we are in between major ice ages in a period that has been called the Holocene. If our media culture and the large portion of the scientific community were really honest, it would be the worshippers of the religion of anthropogenic global warming who are called skeptics, wouldn't it? Because it is those pushing the silly theory that our puny SUVs and power plants are causing Earth to warm up when the most obvious source of heat hangs over our head every single day. And AGW simply doesn't pass the smell test, nor does it line up with the objective data. And hold on one second. Yeah. And this, there's a show a graph, but it says solar activity is also increasing, and we are coming out of the little ice age of just a few hundred years ago. Of course, the planet is warming, and we're coming out of a cold spell, and the Marauder's minimum P period of the Maunder, rather minimum period of diminished solar activity, coincided with the Little Ice Age when Europe and North America experienced bitter cold winters. About 1,000 years ago, Greenland was warm enough for the Vikings to colonize and grow vineyards. Today, Greenland is almost entirely covered in ice. Tell me, is the Earth warmer today than it was 1,000 years ago?
Huh.
Did we have SUVs and coal power plants in the days of the Vikings? This isn't tough to figure out, people. The only thing tough about the global warming debate is trying to get the facts to match the socialist agenda of the AGW proponents. Try as they might, they just can't do it, and more people are starting to see that. Things like cyclic solar data, warming occurring on other planets such as Mars and Jupiter, just don't line up with the suppositions of the AGW worshippers. They craft all manner of complex calculations and what-ifs, but in the end, the best they can do is say things like, well, we can't prove it now, but by the time we can, it'll be too late.
And we're supposed to
watch our electric bills go up 40% and see our economy devastated on what-ifs and a bunch of garbage that not only doesn't match the evidence, but doesn't even pass the smell test. I'm not as gullible as these shysters seem to think I am, and I don't believe most of the American people are either. And that was a pretty good article, I thought, on solar.
You got to make sure, folks, that you
that
you pay attention.
Yeah, to what's going on. Global warming is a hoax, and you know it's a hoax based on the information that they're trying to tell you. Would you like to read that? That happened yesterday.
That's kind of long and convoluted.
Yeah, it's only a short
one. Yeah, it's not the best article I've ever read.
Okay. Well, I would give you this one, but I don't think you can read it.
No, I can't see that one.
And this one's extremely important.
This is on the Federal Reserve.
Would you like to read this one?
I could never read that.
Do you know this?
No.
Okay.
The Federal Reserve to be subpoenaed by Congress over the Merrill deal.
Oh, you know what else? You know what you might want to read if you don't want to read that one?
Let's see.
There's this one here, which is quite long, but you might want to read that again.
I don't want the folks at home to be waiting too long. No. I think that single payer is more important.
Did you read that one too?
No, it's a short one. I just wanted to do the front of that briefing.
Okay, you want to read this one?
Yeah, this is good. This on the single payer and the democracy deficit. I really want you to go to Brad's blog. And it's a 9-page article, but I can give. And single payer and the democracy deficit, or why corporate control of the media may be hazardous to your health. And Americans think that it's health care that produces health, when there really is very little evidence for that. What turns out to be really important is the nature of caring and sharing in society. Where societies are more equal and economic equality is the thing that is most important in this, people look after each other and pretty well everybody does better. There's almost nothing that is better in a society that tolerates the extreme levels of inequality in the United States. And so we end up dying younger than people in all other rich countries, despite spending half of the world's health care bill. So we spend half of the amount of what the whole world spends on health care, and our people do not live as long as people in similar countries like in Western Europe. They live longer and they live better, folks, despite what they're trying to tell you in the media. They don't work two jobs and they get a lot of vacation in the summer. Who are we? Is this what we have become, a nation that dumps people off like garbage who can't pay their health bills? Michael Moore, following a segment in which a confused elderly woman in a flimsy hospital gown is dumped curbside near a Skid Row rescue mission in his documentary Sicko. In Field States, published in 2006, Professor Noam Chomsky, a preeminent linguist and one of the nation's most prolific political writers, concludes that the U.S. suffers from democracy deficit. The significant gap between the policy positions of the electorate and the elected representatives, which he attributes to the manner in which elections are skillfully managed to avoid issues and marginalize the underlying population, freeing the leadership to serve the substantial people. The deficit is especially acute in what Chomsky describes as the most dysfunctional healthcare system in the industrial world. Chomsky notes that a single-payer system, that is a system in which all medical providers would be paid by a government entity, as now occurs with Medicare, has long been overwhelmingly favored by a considerable majority of the American people. But routinely dismissed now by Obama and by both the corporate media and the leaders of both political parties as lacking political support and not being politically possible. So this report has 8 more pages. I urge you to read it and read the history in the report and what's happening and why we're not getting our good health care system. It's important you know why, so you can lobby for it. Very important.
Okay. And I have one more here that I want to read before we hopefully get our interview queued up here. Says this one is from Scripps News. I think it's critical that people understand what's going on with this. Thousands of everyday products and materials containing radioactive materials are surfacing across the United States and around the world. Common kitchen cheese graters, reclining chairs, women's handbags, and tableware manufactured with contaminated metals have been identified. Some having been in circulation for as long as a decade. So have fencing wire and fence posts, shovel blades, elevator buttons, airline parts, and steel used in construction. A Scripps Howard's News Service investigation has found that, because of haphazard screening, an absence of oversight, and substantial disincentives for businesses to report contamination, no one knows how many tainted goods are in circulation in the United States. But thousands of consumer goods and millions of pounds of unfinished metal and its byproducts have been found to contain low levels of radiation, and experts think the true amount could be much higher, perhaps by a factor of 10. Government records of cases of contamination contain through state and federal Freedom of Information Act requests illustrate the problem. In 2006 in Texas, for example, a recycling facility inadvertently created 500,000 pounds of radioactive steel byproducts after melting metal contaminated with cesium-137. And according to U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission records in Florida in 2001, Another recycler unintentionally did the same and wound up with 1.4 million pounds of radioactive material. And in 1998, 430,000 pounds of steel laced with cobalt-60 made it to the U.S. heartland from Brazil. But an accounting of the multitude of problems is unknown because U.S. and state governments do not require scrapyard recyclers and other businesses a primary line of defense against rogue radiation to screen metal goods and materials for radiation or report it when found, and no federal agency is responsible for oversight. Nobody's going to know how much has been melted into consumer goods, says Ray Turner, an international expert on radiation at Fort Mitchell.
So do we have to each get a Geiger counter for our
houses? Yeah, for our houses, for our chairs, for everything we have.
Find out what we have.
He has helped decontaminate 7 metal recycling facilities that unwittingly melted scrap containing radioactive isotopes. It's your worst nightmare, Turner said. It is also one that has only barely begun to register as a potential threat to health and safety. What is known now is that despite the belief benefit, the shared belief of officials in six states, the federal agencies, that tainted metal is potentially dangerous, should be prevented from coming in unnecessary contact with people and the environment, and should be barred from entering the United States. There is no one in charge of making sure that happens. In fact, the Scripps investigation found that reports are mounting that manufacturers and dealers from China, India, the Soviet bloc, nations, and some African countries are exporting contaminated material and goods, taking advantage of the fact that the United States has no regulations specifying what level of radioactive contamination is too much in raw materials and finished goods. Compounding the problem is the instability of the U.S. agents to fully screen every one of the 24 million cargo containers arriving in the United States each year. And U.S. metal recyclers and scrapyards are not required by any state or federal law to check for radiation in the cast-off materials they collect or report it when they find some. No federal agency is responsible for determining how much tainted material exists and how many consumer and other goods. No one is in charge of reporting, tracking, or analyzing cases once they occur. In fact, the recent discovery of a radioactive cheese grater triggered a bureaucratic game of hot potato, and no agency is taking responsibility. It can be far cheaper and easier for facilities stuck with hot items to sell them to an unwitting manufacturer or dump them surreptitiously than to pay for proper disposal and cleaning, which can cost the plant as much as $50 million. For facilities in 36 states that want to do the right thing, there is nothing they can legally dump the contaminated stuff since the shutdown last year of the site in South Carolina, the only U.S. facility available to them for the disposal. And U.S. government programs to collect the worst of the cast-off radiation, radioactive items, has a two-year waiting list and 9,000-item backlog, and is fielding requests to collect an additional 2,000 newly detected items a year. Experts say you needn't empty your home or metal implements for fear of radiation. The peril from most individual items is generally not considered great, although some could be hazardous on their own. In fact, everyone is exposed every day to the background radiation found in nature. For instance, some ceramic pots emanate low levels of radiation that occur in clay. Granite countertops often contain measurable but individually insignificant amounts of naturally occurring uranium. Other exposures come from small and contained amounts of radiation used in the smoke detectors and medical devices. And the potential danger comes, however, when the cumulative efforts of proximity to radiation, particularly over time and in relation to other contaminants. The precise degree of that danger has not yet been definitively determined for low-level radiation, such as contained in the commonplace goods and materials. Our scientific school of thought, which has been losing favor in recent years, holds that low levels of radiation mean low-level threats. And opposite camps contend that exposure to any level of radiation, especially if it's chronic, carries health risks, and U.S. government has so far sidestepped the issue of how little radiation is too much. According to 2006 reports by a National Academy of Science panel, there is a direct relationship between radiation and the increased risk of cancer. Prolonged exposure can also lead to the birth defects and cataracts, studies have shown, and because the amount of tainted metals in circulation is unknown, the cumulative overall health effect now and over time is impossible to calculate. Whatever it is, there is little debate that unnecessary exposure to radiation is best avoided. There is no threshold of exposure below which low levels of ionizing radiation can be demonstrated to be harmless or beneficial. But Richard Monson, chairman of Committee of Access Health Risks from Exposure to Low Levels of Ionizing Radiation, at the release of the National Academy report, there are no reports of anyone dying or being hurt in the United States after contact with contaminated metal goods, but the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency leaves no doubt that tainted metal poses a particular threat. Radioactively contaminated scrap threatens both human health and the environment, says the EPA. And the Scripps investigation used the Federal Freedom of Information Act to gain access to previous unmined Nuclear Regulatory Commission database. The only official assemblage of reports of radiology-contaminated items that have turned up in scrap yards, trash dumps, and manufactured goods since 1990. But because such reporting is neither required nor consistent, neither state nor federal environmental officials nor many in the scrap metal industry consider the NRC accounts an accurate reflection of the problem's true dimensions. And the only mandatory rule is that anyone knowingly transporting radioactive material must notify the U.S. Department of Transportation. Isn't that amazing? Typically, these go unreported. Hold on just a second here. But because such reporting is neither required nor consistent, I just read that.
Yeah.
One of the most, typically, these go unreported. Whatever number you come up with would not reflect reality. One of the most conservative estimates comes from U.S. Government Accountability Office, which puts the number of radioactively contaminated metal objects unaccounted for in the United States in 2005 at 500,000. Okay? Others suggest the amount is far higher, and the most recent NRC estimate made a decade ago is 20 million pounds of contaminated waste. What is known as the NRC's Nuclear Regulatory Commission's National Nuclear Material Events Database has documented 18,740 cases involving radioactive material in consumer products and metal intended for their manufacture and other inadvertent exposures to the public. The vast majority, such as 1990 state environmental reports obtained under state freedom of information requests, also revealed dozens of others. And a recent example emerged last summer when a Flint, Michigan scrap plant discovered a beat-up kitchen cheese grater that was radioactive, and a China-made grater bearing the well-known ECHO, E-K-C-O brand, was laced with the isotope cobalt-60, and tests showed the gadget to be giving off the equivalent of a chest x-ray over 36 hours of use. Imagine that. And estimated to have been in circulation for as long as a decade, the grater likely was 4 to 5 times more radioactive when it was new. And ECHO's parent company, World Kitchen of Rosemont, described the incident as isolated and found no need to issue a recall. It was not the only cheese grater found. NRC documents show the other cobalt-60 tainted grater had turned up in Jacksonville, Florida in 2006. And the reports do not indicate that the brand of grater it was or if it was related to the one that serviced Michigan. And cobalt-60 also tainted a 430-pound shipment of metal from Brazil in 1998. And the contaminations were detected by a radiation monitor. And, it just goes on and on and on. And I'm going to refer you to this. It's scriptnews.com, okay? And you can check it out. The name of the article is Recycled Radioactive Metal Contaminants in Consumer Products. All right? So I'm hoping that this plays all right. And I will treat you to this interview. So bear with us a second. And this is Steve Nato.
Yeah, he's done a great job.
Yeah, and we'll...
I think the folks
forward.
The rule that removes the gray wolves in Idaho from the endangered species list became final Monday, May 4th. The U.S. Fish and Wild Service's delisting rule affects wolves in Idaho, Montana, and parts of Washington, Oregon, and Utah. Wolves in Wyoming will remain on the endangered species list. I don't know why. I got to ask them that. Idaho has taken over managing wolves under the state law adopted in 2008 and under a wolf population management plan also adopted last year. Let's see. Under state law, wolves that are molesting or attacking livestock or domestic animals may be killed by livestock or animals without a permit from Fish and Game, but the incident must be reported to Fish and Game within 72 hours. The wolves killed would remain the property of the state. Oh, okay. Livestock and domestic animals may take all non... Oh, pardon me. Livestock and domestic animal owners, that's nothing like leaving out the critical noun, may take all non-lethal steps they deem necessary to protect their property. A permit must be obtained from Fish and Game to control wolves, not molesting or attacking livestock or domestic animals. And they're also going to open a hunting season. Fish and Game would apply the same professional wildlife management practices to wolves that is applied to all big game species, which all have recovered from low populations during the early 1900s. The Idaho Fish and Game Commission in March set wolf hunting seasons for the fall of 2009. Seasons will be from September 1st through March 31st. Let's see. That's about it. And let's see, it tells when and where, if you're in Middle Forks or if you're in Lolo when, or Sawtooth, when you'll be able to hunt. But since we're not out there, unless we travel out there, we don't need to know that. But Leo will be coming on in a minute with his brother. One of the questions I'm going to ask him, which I don't understand in this article, is it says wolves in Wyoming will remain on the endangered species list. I wondered if they haven't repopulated as much as they need to in that area. So we can ask him that question. And I'm going to ask him also about wolves in this part of the country, whether we really have a number of wolves here, and what the story is. So are we all ready to have our guest on, Leo?
Yeah.
Leo, are we ready to have our guest on? So maybe you could give me that other article. So, oh, here he is. He's going to be on now.
Hey.
Hey, Steve. Welcome to the LA Steel Show. You with us?
Hey, Steve, can you hear us all right?
Yeah, I can hear you. It's a little faint.
Oh, we'll just speak up a little bit. Is that better?
That's better.
Oh, good. You sound very clear to us.
Oh, good.
You sound like you're right next door. Believe it or not, that's how clear you sound. I'm sorry, we're a little scratchy.
Yeah.
I was just...
With the phone lines out here, sometimes they're not real reliable.
Oh, really? You're that far out in the middle of nowhere, huh?
No, just old phone lines.
Just old phone lines.
You're in Boise.
Right,
and,
yeah.
Yeah. So, Steve, we were just reading about the delisting from the Idaho Fish and Game website, the delisting of the wolves. And now, is that causing you any more of a headache than before they were listed, or what?
Well, no. Delisting has been the ultimate goal from day one when wolves were reintroduced into Idaho and Yellowstone.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea was to get the population high enough to reach recovery goals and to achieve the recovery standards and then delist them. So that actually the numbers were reached successfully in 2002, but it's taken the last 7 years to get everything lined up to get to delisting. There's a lot of other things involved besides just the numbers. So in the meantime, the numbers have grown, the numbers of wolves.
And it says in the article that I'm reading that wolves in Wyoming will still remain on the endangered species list.
Right, and the reason for that is simply that there are the states of Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming are required to provide the Fish and Wildlife Service evidence that they have adequate regulatory mechanisms, what they call regulatory mechanisms are laws and plans and rules in place that will assure long-term survival of wolf populations, mm-hmm. healthy wolf populations in their state. Well, the state of Idaho and Montana has shown that that our plans and laws are more than adequate to assure that wolves are here to stay. But Wyoming, on the other hand, is playing politics and has not satisfied the Fish and Wildlife Service's recovery objectives with their plan. So the service has told them to go back to the drawing board. And meanwhile, they opted to delist in Idaho and Montana and keep them listed in Wyoming until their rules are adequate to maintain the population. So that, you know, the idea
a little bit
that
policy.
They're still safe in uh-huh. Wyoming from any persecution under their plan.
Mm-hmm.
But in Idaho and Wyoming, they're open and subject to state laws and rules. And they're in Idaho and Montana, they're listed as big game animals.
Oh.
Deer and elk and moose and sheep and goats and black bears, mountain lions, they will be subject to all the protections and the rules that these other species have.
Well, then they will have a hunting season too?
Right, yeah, they'll have a hunting season. Wolf populations will grow or can grow and have averaged anywhere from 15 to 25% growth rates over the last half a dozen years or so, most recently around 10 to 15% growth rates. That means that every year you could actually reduce the population or harvest what we call harvest the surplus at 15% to level the population off. So in a population of 1,000 wolves, that'd be 150 wolves a year. It'd be similar to every year we have a hunting season like you guys do on deer.
Mm-hmm.
I know
the surplus
yeah.
deer, and every year you have plenty of deer to hunt the next year. So that's the same thing with wolves or any other big game animal, is that there's a harvestable surplus. And the way that Idaho wants to do it is to have the highest harvest of wolves in areas where we're having the most conflict with livestock and human
mm-hmm.
Activities, as well as those places. There's a few of them in the state where we're having real some noticeable impacts on a few of the big game populations. So we're trying to reduce populations in order to balance those other realities that are out there.
Now, how large an animal is a wolf, actually? I mean, I don't know.
Well, wolves are pretty big animals. The wolves that were introduced into Idaho came from British Columbia and Alberta. And the further north you go in a animal's range, the bigger their body size is.
Oh.
And they're fairly good-sized animals. They're an average adult female would be in the 80-pound range, and the average adult male would be in the 100-pound range. And the largest that we've weighed in Idaho is about 130-pound wolf, and he was a big old pumpkin head of a wolf that had a full belly of meat in addition. So he was a big wolf, but most of them don't get any bigger than that. Their legs, they're from tip of the nose to the end of the tail, they might be 8 foot long, and they'll stand 3+ feet at the shoulders. When they're walking close to you, they're quite impressive because they're so tall. They're all leg.
Oh.
And they look pretty impressive.
Now, my understanding is that the wolf population was reduced because they were impacting ranchers and farmers, livestock, and that's why it was eradicated. Now, how do the ranchers and farmers feel about the fact that wolves were reintroduced, and have they been causing a problem for them?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. The ranchers and farmers that with livestock out, you see, Idaho is about 2/3 public lands.
Mm-hmm.
The federal government, that U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management own or manage most of the lands, public land, in the state of Idaho. But on that public land, there's multiple use. In ranchers, and wool growers, you know, the sheep herders are able to graze. They pay a rental fee, and they graze on these public lands, and in addition to having, of course, the private lands. And wolves don't know the difference between public and private land, and they do cause a lot of problems, particularly in the Mountain West. You have your snow gradient is elevational, and the high elevations get snow first and it leaves last. So all the big game populations are pushed down into low elevations. And that's the same place as you have, you know, in the wintertime when there's snow. That's the same place as, you know, where the private land is. And so you'll have, you know, in the springtime, you'll have a lot of conflicts on private land. And then when the snow melts and the cattle and sheep get moved into the mountains, then you have conflicts up on public land. So, yeah, the ranchers aren't big wolf fans at all. And but they've learned to put up with them, and they do. And they get compensated some for their losses. Obviously, you can't find all the dead animals that wolves kill out there on the in the mountains, and so they lose some money. And so they are the ones that are getting an impact off of wolf recovery. And
I was going to ask you this because I read it here in one of these articles about the kill, the wolf kill, okay, it belongs to the state of Idaho, all right, the actual carcasses.
Right.
Is that, that's correct?
Well, that, as a listed animal, when they were listed.
Oh, when they were listed.
They were federal property, and we had to seize them, you know, and we were only allowed to give the carcasses, you know, hides and skulls for educational purposes now. They're state property once they're delisted as they are today.
Right.
And in order for the private individual to have one, they have to be legally taken.
Oh, I see. Okay, because I read it here somewhere that it was belonged to the state. You know, the carcasses belong to
they're,
the state.
They're state property until
they still are, right?
Are legally possessed or reduced to possession by.
Oh.
For instance, if this fall you came out to Idaho and you wanted to hunt a wolf, you could buy a wolf tag and legally go out into the woods and try to hunt a wolf.
Oh. What the man? These things you said are 8 feet long, huh?
Well. Yeah, the big ones are.
Yeah, the 8 feet. Wow.
Actually, 7-8 foot long from the tip of the nose to the end of the tail. But you know, when they're standing there, they're not that big. You know, they're 5 foot long.
Yeah, they didn't look at you know the ones you see on television and everything. You know, they look like they're like.
Hey, for the listeners who have you know, dogs, you look at your 80-pound Labrador Retriever and you put that into a wolf body. The wolf is longer and taller, but it would weigh the same, mostly because they have to be fairly lean and muscled and in very good shape to cover the ground that they cover.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get up into the 100-120-pound wolf, like a big old Rottweiler, you know, a Rottweiler wouldn't survive long in the wild because it's just too big and bulky and slow. But a wolf, on the other hand, that's that big, has a very specific function. And he's the takedown artist in a pack.
Oh,
Longer, leaner, thinner, more younger wolves are the chasers. They're called the coursing predator, and they'll push an elk or deer or whatever. They'll push the herd until something weakens or something lags behind or takes a left or whatever. Those are the runners. They might run an elk herd a mile trying to push, you know, find a weak one. And then you have your takedown wolf, which is your big bulky one, and he'll be at the end of the line, and he'll attack the prey animal at the end and knock it over, and then finish the job.
Now, are male and female is about equal in the chase, or?
Oh well, the females are smaller. They're more of the chasers. And the younger, you know, a pack of wolves is basically a family group where you know an adult male and a female will have pups, and then you know they'll raise those pups and try to feed them in the second year. Some of those will remain with the pack, and so you'll have subadults. The subadults and the females typically are the runners, and the males are the takedowns, the bigger males. And then, for instance, Yellowstone Park, where you have a lot of bison, the packs that are successful killing bison have more large males in the pack, because you have to be really big and tough to take down a bison.
Yeah, that's true.
A buffalo. And,
I've seen them out there with you.
To run an elk.
Yeah. So essentially, that you think they'll be all right as a delisted now? Do you think they'll
absolutely. The states of Idaho and Montana have promised the federal government and citizens of the United States and the world, actually, that wolves are here to stay. They're going to be managed appropriately in balance with prey animals and the other animals that are out there. We're required by statute, by law, to manage all species. And we're going to manage them at levels high enough so that we can always have a surplus, and that there will always be plenty for connectivity between states, and that they'll be genetically viable. We're talking hundreds of wolves in Idaho alone, and, you know, we'll probably be seeing somewhere in the vicinity of 1,000 to 1,500 wolves in the tri-state area, and that's connected with tens of thousands of wolves in Canada, direct genetic line. So we have, we'll always have lots of wolves out here. If for some reason we were to screw up and mess up, well, they would be reviewed for relisting. But the cool thing about wolves is that their population capabilities, they're such a robust breeder that they can bounce back right away. The only way that they were, the only reason that they were eliminated to begin with was due to poisoning. You know, and the loss of prey when homesteaders and miners and ranchers moved out.
Well, Sarah Palin up there in Alaska, I mean, she hunts them by helicopter.
Okay, it's not over. I just have to, hopefully, it'll be on the other side of this tape.
Aerial shooting of wolves, aerial hunting, because they have no roads.
Yeah.
The only way to get into that backcountry is through aircraft, but in Idaho, we don't allow aerial hunting of wolves, nor poisoning, nor trapping. It's only through fair chase hunting with a bow and arrow or a rifle.
I just had visions of Sarah Palin up there with an Uzi, you know, with an Uzi and just, you know, or an AK-47 shooting wolves from a helicopter.
Well, I can tell you one thing that, you know.
And gas calendar and canisters into their dens, you know, and stuff like that.
Well, the groups that are very good at raising money to, you know, are good at scaring everybody about, you know, the impacts. You know, anybody that wants to raise money will try to scare you into donating money. And we have a lot of experience with that. I'm sure you know all about scare tactics on your show and what the people out there are and aren't doing that get the public involved.
Yeah, but have you seen the new Sarah Palin calendar? An action figure? I saw her in the action figure. She got an AK-47. She's in a bikini. And then the other one is the one on the calendar.
You think it's real?
Why not? She approved it. It's approved by the Republican Party's putting the damn thing out. Yeah.
Well, I don't know anything about
the Sarah Palin calendar.
An Alaska or a Sarah Palin expert, so.
2009.
If you want to talk to me about wolves.
Poor Steve, you're putting him on the spot. One of the things that I wanted to ask you, Steve, is this, you can tell that I'm very naive about wildlife, but I wanted to ask you, on the East Coast, do we have wolves, and are they the same kind of genetic stock as the wolves you have out there?
That's another good question. They're looking for wolves in the northern part of Maine.
Mm-hmm.
They had some wolf activity in New Hampshire, Vermont, right on the Canadian border. The Quebec has wolves, and wolves are likely to move south. But one of the things that's keeping them out of probably repopulating naturally the northern part of the state is one, prey base is reduced up there. Evidently, there's, you know, northern New England has had some problems with being able to maintain deer population, so it's a moose base, and the wolves in the east side are a little bit smaller than on the western U.S., so they're more of a, might have a more difficult time knocking moose down. But the more importantly is that there are real, you know, you've got the reestablishment or the establishment of a huge coyote in the east coast, so you have that hunter niche pretty well filled.
Oh, okay.
So there'd be a lot of competition, and the coyote population on the East Coast now is pretty big. So I'm not sure that you'd have a real easy, natural movement of wolves coming down. But there are supposedly some up there, and I've seen recently some news releases of where they're going to try to find wolves through surveys and inventories over the next summer or two in northern Maine and in other parts of northern New England.
How about, not to change the subject, but I, in the time we got left, I wanted to talk a little bit about bears. We got right where we live.
Which is in a small town.
But there's two of our neighbors on both sides of us actually reported bears on their front doors, okay?
On their front steps.
And on their front steps. And it was black. They were black. I think it's the same, probably the same one, but it's a black bear. And pretty good size from what
probably
they were saying.
Probably weighed about 400 pounds, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just glad that I didn't see it or meet it.
But if you happen to, what they did, these are two women that happened to run into them. One was at night when she was coming home, and the next one was in the morning.
In the morning.
She was getting out, going outside.
About 6 o'clock in the morning.
And she saw one peeking over her fence, which is about waist high. And it ran, and she went back into the house immediately. But I was
and the other
curious,
neighbor.
What would somebody actually do if you have one browsing around your house and trying to break into your I mean, how do you get rid of a bear, you know, without shooting the thing, you know?
Well, it's not uncommon at all for bears to be investigating neighborhoods, particularly close to. I mean, there's a lot of bears in throughout New England and New Jersey just opened the hunting season on bears a year or so ago, and New York has a lot of bear activity. All the states back there with any woodlands and mass production, what we call mass production, you know, beech nuts and berries and things. Of course, bears back east love the cornfields. You know, you got your Pennsylvania black bear, which can grow to be 500-600 pounds.
Hmm.
Huge, huge bears back there simply because there's so much
corn.
So much food available. And those bears in your neighborhood that are coming in are looking for garbage when they're food stress periods, when the natural foods are rare. And they will come in and look, and smell around the neighborhoods looking for cat food, dog food left outside, and garbage primarily.
Yeah, anything, yeah. If you walk into one, which I haven't, but they have, and they were successful in getting rid of it, they called the cops, and the cops came over and kind of shoot it away somehow.
Shouldn't they be trying
to relocate this bear that keeps coming into the neighborhood?
On its proximity to the woods, you know.
Right, it's pretty close, unfortunately. It's not,
the woods are right in back of
it. Yeah, it's within 100 feet, you know.
You can scare them.
That's what.
You can haze them with rubber bullets and sirens and all sorts of things. To try to scare them away, but that's a temporary fix. The long-term fix is to get rid of the attractants.
Yeah, the anything. Yeah.
Garbage day is Thursday morning, and you put all your garbage out Wednesday night. Chances are the bears know that,
and
they're going to go through the neighborhood on Wednesday night. So what we always recommend people do is keep the garbage. If you're having bears in the neighborhood problems, and every state. In the northern part of the country has bear problems at some times of the year, and what we recommend is to keep your garbage in a garage until it's time to put it out, in the morning before the garbage collector comes. Make sure your bird feeders, you don't have bird feeders out there, very attractive to bears. There's lots of things that attract bears.
Do they like grills? Everybody seems to have a grill.
Gardens and all that stuff.
Oh, okay.
Anything that smells.
Now, this is going to be another naive question, but do bears have a certain amount of territory that is their own? Are they more of a solitary animal than, say, a wolf?
That's not a naive question at all. It's a good question. Bears defend a territory around themselves.
Okay.
And they have this self-defense or this defensive perimeter where some bears... it's a small defensive perimeter. If you're a young bear, and if there's lots of food around, a lot of times bears will congregate. But if you're an older dominant bear, you might have a bigger defensive perimeter, and you'll scare and attack bears around you. They're not territorial. They don't defend a territory. They do have home ranges, and they will roam through their home range looking for food. They have mental maps of all the great places to eat at different times of the year. And that's what they do. The males have big home ranges, and the females have smaller home ranges.
I don't know. If you run into one, run away from it, basically.
If you're near your car, jump back in your car. Black bears are not real aggressive predators.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
Most of the country, they're just big clowns that go out and try to find easy food. they're pretty docile. Every now and again, somebody will get injured by a black bear, usually when they're trying to feed it, or they get, every now and again you have a bear act aggressively to protect its cubs or some other reason, but for the most part, bear injuries due to black bears are pretty rare.
Well, that's comforting. In the last couple of minutes, we just have one or two more minutes to talk with you. Do you have anything that you want to say about animals or any advice you want to give our listeners at home about wild animals?
Treat all wild animals as wild animals. They're not pets. They're not domesticated. They don't understand human nature. If you're having wild animal problems, your local fish and game office would be very willing to answer questions and provide information, educational materials to help you out. Don't feel as though you're on your own. There's lots of resources out there to help familiarize you with wildlife in your neighborhood.
Yeah, that's fishandgame.idaho.gov.
You don't have to call me.
Yeah, right.
You don't want a lot of phone calls.
Your local fish and game office. I mean, you're more than welcome to call Idaho for information on Connecticut, but
I was thinking if they wanted information on wolves or they wanted information on stuff like that.
Call your local Connecticut fish and game office there. And,
okay.
They would give you local information and be able to answer your questions and assist you at a much better ability than us out here.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much, Steve.
Well, I wanted to ask, we still got a few minutes. I just wanted to ask him a question because he was just recently out to the Galapagos Islands.
And
I really haven't had a chance to talk. Kara had a lot to say about it, which is Steve's wife. But I wanted to get your impression of what it was like out there.
Well, if you're a wildlife biologist, it's a dream trip. It's everything that we expected it to be. The thing about the Galapagos, of course, is that's where Darwin developed his origin of species theories and of evolution. And when you go and visit the islands, we did it on a boat, a 16-passenger boat, and you go to bed at night and wake up on a new island the next morning, and you go explore with different subspecies, different vegetation, and the species that adapting to that vegetation. It's called adaptive radiation, and this, the evolution of species, it kind of slaps you in the face out on these islands, so you understand how he developed these theories, and it's very enlightening and extremely exciting for biologists, and they do a really nice job of controlling visitors out there, and of course the wildlife is not used to predators, so they're very open to photography and to sitting there and watching them, and the snorkeling is pretty nice diving, and the whole experience is very worthwhile for people. It's down along the equator. The interesting thing is you would expect it to be very, very hot on the equator, and it isn't that bad through most of the year. The seasons are dominated by ocean currents as opposed to, like our seasons here that are based on the angle of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And so the ocean currents, there's two seasons basically, and the summertime right now it's a little bit cooler, and the water is a little bit cooler due to the ocean currents, and their hot season is in our winter, and it's in the 80s typically down there. It can be kind of humid, but it's any time of year is a good time to visit the Galapagos, and it's a real worthwhile trip if anybody's interested in wildlife, and some pretty spectacular scenery.
So I was glad to hear you had a great time out there. And before we end, I just got about a minute left, but I wanted to say our mother's out there visiting you, and she just had a birthday, so I wanted to wish her a happy birthday on the air and let our millions of listeners wish her a happy birthday as well.
Well, I'll make sure that she hears that when she listens to
me. So, anyway.
Happy birthday, Mom.
Yeah, have a great time there, Steve, and I'll be talking to you later.
All right, well.
And I appreciate you being on. Thanks so much.
Good night, Steve.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Steve Nadeau talking to us from his home out in Boise, Idaho, about wolves, bears, and other wildlife, and the Galapagos Islands.
Yeah, that was my brother Steve's, by the way. So, we're going to say goodnight. So what we'd like to do is leave you with a song. And happy trails. Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling on till then. Happy trails to you till we meet again.
And thanks for choosing the LA Steel Show. Choose us again next week, every Tuesday night from 8 to 10 o'clock. And I really appreciate having you with us, and I look forward to you hearing us next week.
And
have
forget,
a great week.
Don't forget, if you want to listen to what we do Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday night on the LASteelShow.org, and you can go to that. Also, trying to find my closing here.
You can't find it.
My closing.
Also, you can hear us on Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah. You can hear us doing that.
And that is anyway, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday night. And Friday night is with George Dixon.
Right.
So I want to thank you for being with us. And I'm saying good night.
Oh, here we go. Okay.
Here you go, Lee.
I was an hour ahead of myself. Okay. I want to thank everybody. And don't forget, LASteelShow.org, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday night. And join us right here next week as well. Tell all your friends you can get us on WQQQ.com live every Tuesday night as well. So thank you and good night. You've been listening to the LA Steel Talk Radio Show. Join us here again every Tuesday night, 8 to 10 p.m. on Q103.3. The opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of the management, staff, or advertisers of Q103 FM.
Okay, and that was an interview with my brother Steve out in Idaho. And I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight. Hope you had a good, hope you enjoyed the show. And join me tomorrow night, same time, 8 o'clock, here on, either you're listening to it on LASteelShow.org or on blogtalkradio.com/LASteelShow.org. Either way, I hope you enjoy the show. And join us tomorrow night as we delve into the spiritual aspects of things. I think I'll be reading some works by Rumi, the Sufi master. Been doing some research on that. Fascinating and very, very interesting guy, but funny. A funny Sufi, actually. A funny spiritual man. And we will delve into that tomorrow evening at 8 o'clock. And on Friday night, join us at 8 with George Dixon as we enter the areas of esoteric knowledge and ufology and so on. And we'll be covering a lot of ground on Friday night as well. So thank you, and have a pleasant evening. Good night.